calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, everything sometimes, you think you know what's going on, right? We went into Iraq. One of the arguments that's made on the Reich is, we went into Iraq because this is the only guy who ever used chemical weapons, illegal weapons, weapons of mass destruction against his own people.
As
the only
know,
guy.
There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. And think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. And if one looks throughout the history of our country and other free countries, it is the latter category that tend to be the difficult ones.
Well, the unknown unknown right now is the United States, or did the United States, in the assault on Fallujah, and perhaps in other places for that matter, now that for all practical purposes there are not reporters in most of the Iraqi theater. Most of them are hanging out in the green zone. We've had, you know, some 50-odd reporters killed in Iraq. Is it possible that the United States is using banned weapons, incendiary arms, phosphorus bombs against civilians? These are weapons. These are bombs that basically, it's like napalm. It's even worse than napalm because there's so much hotter and so much faster burning against civilians in Fallujah. The Italian state television RAI has just broadcast a documentary. This from BBC News has just broadcast a documentary accusing the United States military of using phosphorus bombs against civilians in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. In the film, reports the BBC News, eyewitnesses and ex-U.S. soldiers who served in Iraq said white phosphorus bombs were used in built-up areas in the insurgent-held city. Rai, the Italian state TV network, says this amounts to the illegal use of chemical weapons, though such bombs are considered incendiary devices. The U.S. military admits using the weapon in Iraq to illuminate battlefields. But U.S. military officials deny using it in built-up areas. Washington is not a signatory of an international treaty restricting the use of white phosphorus devices. Then they have a definition of white phosphorus. This is from Protocol 3 of the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons. Spontaneously flammable chemicals used for battlefield illumination. Contact with particles causes burning of skin and flesh. Use of incendiary weapons is prohibited for attacking civilians. This is Protocol 3, but the U.S. has not signed this. The documentary began with formerly classified footage of the Americans using napalm bombs during the Vietnam War. Showed a series of photographs of corpses with the flesh burnt off, clothes still intact, which says is consistent with the effect of white phosphorus on humans. The film also says Washington has systematically attempted to destroy filmed evidence of the alleged use of white phosphorus on civilians in Fallujah. This is not helping. I'm telling you, this is not helping the way the world is viewing the United States. Even in Italy, you know, part of the coalition of the billing. Even in Italy, where Silvio Berlusconi is good buddies with George W. Bush. I mean, you know, billionaires all, right? And, Bush is a millionaire, but his family certainly. In any case, even in Italy where you've got, you know, a friendly government, you've got strong, strong opposition to the United States and to Italy involving itself in the affairs of Iraq. And now the phosphorus bombs. Just not a good thing. So anyhow, I wanted to share that with you. We'll see where that goes. It's going to be interesting to see if the U.S. media, if the mainstream media in the United States picks up this story at all, now that it's being broadcast all over Europe. Today is Election Day. The initiative, Schwarzenegger's initiatives, his anti-labor, anti-education, you know, advance the right-wing agenda initiatives in California, Now, the polling is showing that they're too close for comfort. Be sure to get out and vote. And the very simple, vote yes on Prop 79 and 80. Prop 79, Cheaper Prescription Drugs for Californians Act, state-negotiated rebates. And Prop 80, vote yes on Affordable Electricity and Preventing Blackouts Act, establishes an energy policy for California that guarantees the lights stay on. These are both considered progressive acts. And then the California Democratic Party is strongly suggesting that people vote no on Propositions 73, 74, 75, 76, 77, and 78. 73 through 78, no. 79 and 80, yes. And 73 would terminate, it would involve a waiting period and parental notification for basically minors who want to have an abortion. I mean, it's the bottom line. It's a parental notification. This is, again, we've had this discussion before. In an Ozzie and Harriet world, makes perfect sense. But this is not an Ozzie and Harriet world. Only a few of us are privileged to live in an Ozzie and Harriet world. And sorry, Republicans, you can't impose that on people. And you can't say that simply because Ozzie and Harriet would live that way, that and the people who, in many cases, by no choice of their own, have to live by the rules of that world, even though they don't live in that world. No on Proposition 73. A waiting period for permanent status for public school teachers. This is Proposition 74. This is just, you know, Schwarzenegger's attempt to kneecap the teachers union. Not just the teachers union, teachers. To reduce the power of, the teachers union as well. He's you know, absolutely opposed to any sort of union activity. You'll recall when Schwarzenegger first started running, he was his big, I will not take any money from special interests. And then all of a sudden, he's taking money from, like, Enron. He's taking money. He was having secret meetings with Enron just before the big emergency, before the big energy crisis that led to his becoming governor. He was having secret meetings down in Beverly Hills or Bel Air with Ken Lay. To this day, he hasn't answered any questions about what those were about. So anyhow, he says, I will not take money from special interests. And then all of a sudden, all this corporate money's flooding into his campaign. Oh, corporations are not special interests. Yeah. So anyhow, for our listeners in California, Proposition 74. See, and for listeners outside of California, you know, these are coming to a town near you. I'm telling you, you need to pay attention because what Schwarzenegger is doing in California is being done all over the United States. And if it isn't in you're not having an election today, you will next year. And a lot of these things, Prop 75, no public union employee union dues. This would silence union employees. We've discussed that at some length on this program. Vote no on Proposition 76. To cut school spending, basically, and vote no on Propositions 77 and 78. 77 is reapportionment. It's, let's fix this thing so Republicans are elected forever. And in 78, prescription drug discounts sponsored by all the major pharmaceutical companies. That should tell you enough right there in and of itself. So this is, I'm agreeing with the California Democratic Party. Vote no, 73 through 78. Vote yes, 79 and 80. If you happen to live in California. In Sonoma County, Measure M is on the ballot. This is a really important one in Sonoma County, which would, and I know we're on a radio station there, which would measure a measure to establish a 10-year moratorium on allowing genetically modified crops into the county. So be sure to vote yes on Measure M. For those folks listening at KSRO in Santa Rosa, I believe it is, voting yes on Measure M means you support the 10-year moratorium. So consider that. Go for it. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
W.ALA.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I've heard
that other countries are down on the U.S. A land of mass consumption, our lives filled with excess. But my daddy wasn't fighting on Normandy that day for the right to drive a Hyundai. I refuse to live that way. And I'm proud to be an American who gets just 5 mpg. Though I live alone, the car I own can seat 103. And I'll gladly park so close to you, when you pull out you can't see. No, I'll never trade my Escalade. God bless my SUV.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's funny, I was just talking with Heidi, who does our local show with us, and I was talking about my Prius. I own a Toyota Prius 2002, and the local guy here in Oregon who just won the big Powerball lottery just went out and bought a giant SUV, a Hummer. And I said, you know, if I hit the lottery, I'd buy a new Prius. The one I have is 3 or 4 years old. And the problem that I have is if I trade it in, it has two bullet holes in it. After I started doing this program, back when we were living in Vermont, somebody drove by and shot out one of the windows and left a couple of bullets in the door. And I've never cleaned them up. I always thought that it was kind of cool. You know, it's a badge of honor or whatever, bullet holes in my car. But I know if I go to a car dealer, they're gonna say, hey, bullet holes will knock $500 off what we'll give you, you know, or whatever. I don't know what it costs to fix a bullet hole. So I haven't traded in my car. But anyhow, this guy with his SUV, it's remarkable. Welcome back to the program. The situation in France, I think, is a fascinating one, and I wanted to just, you know, raise the question, you know, what's going on? France is burning right now, and or parts of it are. And there's a very real possibility that this may spread to other parts of Europe, although in France in particular, it's a substantial problem. And Louise and I were talking about this yesterday. I remember back in the 70s, the neighborhood actually that I was a child in Detroit, I mean, like when I was 1 year old, I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My parents then moved to Detroit and lived there for a year or so. And then we ended up back in Lansing, which is where I grew up. And the block of apartment buildings in Detroit where I lived as a 1 year old, and where this elderly couple who Holocaust survivors helped raise me, you know, friends of my parents, which is one of the reasons why my first language is sort of half English, half Yiddish. In any case, that block burned during the riots in the 70s. It's gone. It's no longer there. The apartment building that I grew up in, or that I, you know, lived in for a short time as a baby, and some 50 years ago. And you look back on the riots that we had in the United States and ask, you know, why? And it seems that it was the end of the era of enfranchisement for a lot of people. A lot of African Americans in particular, I think, felt that the promise of the Great Society, the promise of Brown versus Board of Education, the promise of the Civil Rights Act, Brown versus Board of Education 1954, the Civil Rights Act 1967, the Great Society 1964, 65, 66, that the promise of these things to lift people out of poverty was actually in some ways quite successful. I mean, Lyndon Johnson reduced poverty by 50% in America in a 4-year period. It was pretty dramatic. And yet, it was not entirely there. It's like, in part because this was the beginning of the disintegration of the great middle class economy. 1973, oddly enough, you know, I talk about Ronald Reagan and everything started unraveling when Reagan came into power in 1980. But really, if you look at a curve, you see that 1973 was the year of peak income. When you balance everything out for inflation and everything, it was the year of peak income for Americans. And so, you know, it was the beginning of the unraveling of the American dream. And I think that, you know, a little bit of discrimination in a society where there's a lot of jobs and, you know, is relatively invisible even to the people who are being discriminated against. Relatively, I say, not absolutely by any means. But that same little bit of discrimination in a society that is under stress, where the jobs are starting to go away, as they are in France right now, as Eastern European countries are coming in and as free trade is prevailing, then becomes a huge big deal. And so there's a lot of theories about what's going on in France right now is it an Islamic thing? I don't think so. Is it because there's Africans who are not Islamic who are participating. Is it a thing of European, white European French versus multi-ethnic or other colored French people? It appears to be. And could that be because of discrimination within French society and that discrimination translating into economic problems? I think probably almost certainly. And so, you know, what's a country to do? And where is this leading? Pat Buchanan wrote an interesting piece in Human Events, Paris Burning, How Empires End, suggesting basically this is the end of the French Empire. And that the same thing will happen in America, he says, in the next 30, 40 years. And that's an interesting take, too. So it's something to ponder and take your thoughts on it.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Into the distance, ribbon of black, stretched to the point of no turning back. Flight of fancy on a windswept field, standing alone, my senses reel.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. I find this fascinating, the various takes on what's going on in Paris right now. And I think America, having experienced what appeared to be racially based riots and burnings of cities in the 60s and 70s, perhaps we should have some perspective on this, some take on it. And in fact, the Kerner Commission, if my recollection is correct, the Kerner Commission, which looked into the riots, said that the root cause of it was white racism. And there is no doubt in my mind that were there not white racism, that we would not have had those riots. So I think that's absolutely true. Pat Buchanan is suggesting in this piece on online human events titled Paris Burning, How Empires End, that what this is the end of the empire. He says, he talks about how the Romans, he doesn't actually give the whole backstory of this. The Romans deforested Italy in acquiring fuel. They ran out of gas. They ran out of fuel. And, you know, they cut down all the trees so much so that it created a currency crisis in Italy. It became so expensive for the wood to burn, to smelt silver to make the coins, that the value of silver doubled a couple of times over a very short period of years. I forget the number of years. And it just rattled the empire. I mean, it was a terrible currency crisis for Italy, for Rome, for the Roman Empire. And so they had to get more wood. And so they reached out. This is when they built their 50 wooden ships, or however many it was, 30 wooden ships, whatever the famous wooden ships, and went off across the Mediterranean, started conquering other lands, and started, you know, bringing both wood and slaves and all kinds of goodies back to Italy. And the Roman Empire began to reach out and become empire rather than just, you know, just Italy, just Romulus and Remus's hometown, right? Rome and the surrounding areas. And he points out that Rome conquered the barbarians, you know, the Central Europeans, the Germans and whatnot, and then the barbarians conquered Rome. In other words, Italy became part of Europe, as it were. He says, and so it goes with empires. And he suggests that what's going on is that because France had allowed people who are of non-French, that is to say, not white European French-speaking ancestry, although many of them speak French, into the country as citizens. The Algerians, the Tunisians, these are the countries that France had conquered when it was playing empire. That because there's these non-Aryan people or non-French-looking white European people in the country, and that the distinction that Buchanan draws is that, you know, he says this is what's leading to the riots. And the distinction that he draws is that even African Americans in the United States in the 1960s and 70s were, even in a segregated society, were still largely participating in American popular culture. They watched the same TV shows. By and large, most of them were Christian. They were part of the majority religion anyway in the country. They were part of the mainstream even in the face of segregation. Whereas Buchanan suggests in France you have people who are of a different religion and a different race, and in some cases speak a second language or even another first language in addition to French. And therefore, he says, this is never going to end. It's only going to get worse. Whereas in the United States, there was kind of an assimilation. And Buchanan, you know, I have to say, I went and heard him speak. We took our kids to hear him speak, in fact, when he came to Atlanta when he was running for president some, I don't know, 10, 15, it must have been 15, 16 years ago. And I said to the kids, I said, I want you to hear a demagogue. This is what the people in Germany were listening to when Hitler in the early 1930s. You're going to hear a guy who's just going to whip the crowd up, and he's going to talk about, you know, those people, and he's going to be, in all probability spewing out hate. And sure enough, Buchanan got up and he gave this speech, and a good chunk of the speech, and there was a couple thousand people there in the Cobb County Civic Center. We were living then in Newt Gingrich's district in the northern kind of white bread suburbs of Atlanta. And Buchanan just had them whipped up into a frenzy. There were a bunch of skinheads there, and I don't think there was, other than the black guy who introduced him from the stage, I don't think that there was a face of color anywhere in the audience. And Buchanan spent a good chunk of his speech talking about those people. And most of those people he was railing against were the international bankers and those people who control much of international commerce. And it was quite clear from the context of his speech that he was speaking of Jews. And so, you know, here's this guy who's anti-Semitic. He's at least it appeared that way to me. And it appeared to me that, you know, he was taking a fairly racist position. And he writes this article now in Human Events Online that, in a way, is promoting that same thing. In fact, his warning at the end is that by 2050, there's going to be 100 million Hispanics in the United States, half of them of Mexican ancestry, heavily concentrated in the Southwest, that most Mexicans still believe by right belongs to them. And then he ends it. He says, colonization of the mother countries by subject people is the last chapter in the history of empires and the next chapter in the history of the West that is now coming to a close. So he's predicting, you know, dire consequences because essentially nations are not maintaining, what, racial purity, cultural purity, religious purity? Consistency. And this is, I think, where most Americans and Pat Buchanan kind of go in different directions, and certainly where I go in a different direction from Pat Buchanan. He might be accurately diagnosing some dimension of the problem in suggesting that Algerian immigrants into Paris have not assimilated themselves into French culture, and that's, you know, part of the problem. Or at least part of the problem of why there's going to be an ongoing problem. And it's going to present an increasing problem for French society. But I would say if there wasn't a racist element to it, you know, it probably wouldn't be that big a deal. I mean, Alsace-Lorraine region, there are countries that are profoundly multicultural. I was thinking of Alsace-Lorraine, which is this part of France that, you know, one year is France, the next year is Germany. It's gone back and forth so many times nobody can remember over the last 1,000 years. And my wife's father's family is from there. And we visited that region. And there's parts of Alsace-Lorraine where everybody speaks German. And yet it's in France. And, you know, because, you know, 50 years ago it was part of Germany. And then, you know, 50 years before that it was part of France. And then 50 years before that it was part of Germany. A better example is probably Switzerland. I've traveled throughout Switzerland, and there are parts of Switzerland that speak Italian. There are parts of Switzerland that speak French. There are parts of Switzerland that speak German. And pretty much everybody in Switzerland speaks a little bit of English. And most speak at least one or two languages, but it's very multicultural. Now, it's not multiracial, so, you know, Pat Buchanan's response, I would guess, would be, well, you know, it's all about race, it's not about culture. But I don't think so. I'm sorry, I just don't think so. And he would say, also, they're all Christians in Switzerland, and whereas in France you've got Christians and Muslims, and, you know, so in his world. But I think that, you know, where most Americans separate from this kind of nationalistic, paranoid perspective is that we really believe in the possibility of having multiculturalism. That is to say, we will accept other cultures in this country. You know, I've said on this program many times that the velvet glove over the iron fist of empire is the language that white European culture in the United States of America has very often historically used to speak to people of color or to speak to people of other religions, to say essentially, we are perfectly willing, we're very pleased, we'd be enthusiastic to have you come in and be part of our society as long as you become just like us. Because our and the subtext of that is because our culture is the best culture. And your culture is an inferior culture. That's the message that is subtly communicated. And I think probably most white Europeans or most white Americans rather are completely unaware of it. It doesn't occur to them. And I think most people of color in this country get it. Certainly Native Americans in this country get it. They know, you know, that it's all about empire and it's all about, you know, deciding, you know, am I going to assimilate? And so these are tough issues fundamentally. Is it possible for a country to embrace multiple cultures? I think it is. For a country to embrace multiple cultures and still have a national identity. Why can't that national identity be, we're the nation that embraces multiple cultures, and they don't have to become like us? We are going to, you know, honor Native Americans and let them participate and practice their religions, even if it involves peyote. We are going to honor Muslims here. We are going to honor, the list goes on and on, you know, Buddhists and Hindus. This is a multicultural nation. Now, I would suggest that the view that Buchanan is espousing of basically xenophobia, you know, of fear of other cultures, is one that is pretty much very, very common in France. I mean, the French are so paranoid about other cultures, they have laws about how much programming from outside France can be on their national television networks. They have, you know, French-only laws about the use of language. And you can't introduce new words into the French language. You have to come up with a French word for something, for some new invention. Could it be that the French xenophobia, the Pat Buchanan perspective of the French, is what's driving this? I think that you could build a good case for that. 45 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Harpin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
See that the government's gonna protect us. Use all the brain power down in Crawford, Texas. Buildings keep falling, the wind keeps blowing. Levees overrunning, the river keeps flowing. Get out of the way, hurricane senior. Call a Home Depot, don't bother FEMA. Big winds are coming and the Mideast are cooking. And old George Bush just standing there looking.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Harpin here with you. Mike in Sonoma, California on the line, our number 866-440-THOM. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Well, good morning, Tom. I don't want all this to sound like reminiscent, but I want to establish a time frame here.
Sure.
I was a college student in San Francisco and Berkeley in the 60s and early 70s, and at the same time that we were having constant demonstrations at San Francisco State and at Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
and in Oakland with the Black Panthers, and even conservative Stanford had our student body president was David Harris, and so having to do with this when I tuned you in, I caught the beginning of it, and then you got into Pat Buchanan, this being a cultural thing. I think we certainly made an impact that did turn out to be culture, having everything to do with starting to put an end to the Vietnam War, to the feelings of the blacks in primarily Oakland, but the whole Bay Area, and that spread across the country. And I think it did turn in to be a very cultural thing rather than just.
Are you saying, Mike, that the riots that happened in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s actually produced ultimately some positive change in our society?
I certainly think so, and I think it set a precedent in what was...
That's my sense of it, too, that it got a hell of a lot of attention. A lot of folks woke up. And you think the same thing will happen in France?
As hard as I study this, and with the number of Frenchmen that I know, I seem to think so, because it's very different from the way that they were able to, as you recall, a fairly short time ago. Well, it hadn't been that short a time now, like 20 years ago. The French government would just go in and eradicate outbreaks like this.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not being able to do it now. So I think something, it is definitely a cultural thing, and it's gonna change the French way of thinking about everything. I mean,
this is then going to require a change in French culture, because the point that Buchanan makes is that African Americans in the United States in the 60s and 70s were largely integrated into, quote, American culture, end quote. That is that, most of them were Christian. Most of them, even though our churches were segregated, they were going to church. Most of them, and of course that's Buchanan's big thing, but they all spoke English. Everybody, we were speaking the same language. We were all watching the same TV programs. We were all going to the same movies, even if they were segregated. And whereas in France, he suggests that the Algerian and Moroccan immigrants into France who become fully French citizens are not speaking French as their first language. They are not participating in French Christianity, although in Europe participation in religion is very low to begin with.
Yes, right.
They've really created a culture apart. And he sees, and his paranoia, of course, is that he's seen the same thing happening in the Hispanic population in the United States right now. It's becoming a culture apart, both on the basis of race and language and culture. And he sees this as something that causes societies to disintegrate and a consequence of empire. And, what's your take on that?
Well, I'll start with some very basic thing, which is I'll treat as humorous. It's going to be pretty hard to get the French to change their language.
Well,
they're pretty stuck. But no, but I don't mean that with all seriousness, Tom. But I mean it's true. I mean you know how the French are with their
language. Well, and that's my point. I mean I haven't lived in France. I lived in Germany, which is the next country over, and the Germans aren't all that different, by the way, than the French when it comes to Deutschland über alles.
Pride in their language. And
that's right. Yeah, and the Germans were and are having a big problem with the Turkmen that they have brought in. They call them Gastarbeiters, guest workers, who are now full citizens of Germany that they brought in after World War II to help in rebuilding. Because again, it's this kind of race apart. While Buchanan is saying that it's the separation, these differences are causing the problem. What I'm saying is that the problem is caused by the dominant culture, the culture that has the most power, the most money, and the most police, not being willing to say we are a multicultural culture. That's our definition of our culture, is that it's not this narrow little thing. It's a much larger thing.
Well, I for that reason, I do agree with you, much the way, for instance, S.I. Hayakawa. Do you remember him?
I do.
Okay, well, he became the president of San Francisco State, and he was going to come in kind of like a Buchanan and put out all these fears about what we were doing on that campus, and created these fears and tried to really come after us in a very, very forceful way. And so I there are so many similarities, and I think we certainly have not won this, and who knows if we ever will, but we certainly put a tremendous amount of thought into a lot of people's heads that has, I think, stuck with a great many of us now.
Yeah, and I think Hayakawa shot himself in the foot big time in a lot of ways.
Oh,
Mike, thank you.
Absolutely.
You have some very good thoughts there. Ruth Ann in New Albany, Indiana. Ruth Ann, we only have 20 seconds left. A quick point.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, I agree with you theoretically, but practically I'm not sure, you know, how this really works. I think really the French, probably it's reasonable for them to want to retain their own culture.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that point, but the question then is, if you're going to decide as a nation that you're going to act like empire and bring in people who don't want to be part of your culture, what are you going to do?
Well, that's true. Then why have them?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, America's adaptation of that over the last 200 years, the way that we've resolved the issue of slaves among us and Native Americans among us, is to reinvent ourselves as the myth of the great melting pot. And I think if the French don't do the same thing, they're going to be in big trouble. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out. Ruth Ann, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Great to hear from you. And Mike and everybody else. It's Tom Hartman, radio programmer. Telephone number 1-866-440-8466. This and more as we continue.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, telling the truths that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about, generally speaking. We're going to pick up the topic of what's going on in France, what's going on with the elections around the country today, what's going on with the Bush Empire imploding in just a few minutes. First, just for this segment, I wanted to bring in Betsy Taylor with NewDream.org, our Bioneers guest for the day. Bioneers are for the week, in fact. Bioneers, founded in 1990, a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. And Betsy Taylor is the founder and president of the Center for a New American Dream, which sounds suspiciously like the Center for the New American Project.
No, Tom.
No parallels, Betsy.
No, not this time. Okay. Thank
goodness. So what is the American Dream you're proposing?
Well, we're working for a new dream that is really based on building a future where it can go on indefinitely, and we can feel safe, and we can be healthy, and we can wake up in the morning feeling positive rather than fearful. And it's about sustainability. How can we live and consume in ways that are conserving resources and protecting the natural world and promoting, you know, decent wages and labor conditions for the people who make the things we buy?
So you're suggesting that being socially responsible, that being ecologically conscious is going to drive social consciousness, or is it the other way around?
I mean, we're really looking at the issue of American consumption. And if you look at American consumption, it's pretty staggering. We consume more per capita than anybody else on the planet, and that's especially the case with things like oil.
We consume 7 times more than the average European, 30 times more than the average Indian, 50 times more than the average African. It's pretty mind-boggling.
And, you know, that is not just a source of environmental destruction, although it is that in spades. It is also the source of global conflict. It's the source of growing tensions around everyone needing to have their fair share. And if one bully is taking more than their share, it's just not going to work in terms of not only our planet, but in terms of world peace. So there are things people can do. You know, you might despair sometimes about where the federal government's heading, but there are things individuals can do, churches, schools, organizations, companies can do to buy differently and to support the production of things that are made to be durable, to last, not to be wasteful, to be healthy.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, and I think that these are really important steps to take to say that, you know, for example, if I'm going to have a cup of coffee, I'm going to try and find, you know, shade grown, organically grown, fair trade coffee.
Right.
And you know, support somebody in Nicaragua who's, you know, trying to make a decent living and isn't destroying the planet. Or that if I'm going to buy a car, I'm going to, you know, use it for, you know, as long as it's practical lifetime and get something that's durable, or, you know, toys for kids, or in my case, you know, hopefully one day grandkids, that would be things that, you know, they might pass along to their children rather than something that they're going to throw away after 6 weeks. But isn't advocating voting with your dollars, essentially, for these kinds of things, doesn't that mean that those people with the most dollars have the most votes?
Well, yes and no. We're not just saying vote with your dollars. We're saying live consciously and buy wisely. So sometimes, you know, it's about not spending, which can be really good for our own financial security rather than getting seduced by advertisements that tell us we have to have the latest this or that. Sometimes it's in our own interest as well as in the environment's interest just to say, hey, you know, I'm going to get more, but not more stuff, more fun, more time with my kids, more time doing things. So part of it is that. But, you know, your fundamental question is a fair one. No doubt when it comes to green products, fair trade products, for the most part, they tend to be a little more expensive. But there are things that a low-income buyer can also do to use their dollars in a way that reflect their values. For example, you know, I just went personally to a thrift store, and, you know, some people are into vintage clothes and some aren't, but if you're into them, they can be very cool and very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and a lot of people are involuntarily into them. I mean, this really raises the issue. We're talking with Betsy Taylor, the founder and president of the Center for a New American Dream. And by the way, is there a website for this, Betsy?
Yeah, www.newdream.org.
Okay, newdream.org. And it's that, you know, this all sounds very, very, very fine for people who, by and large, are white middle class and above. It's going to be much more of a challenge for people of color in America or for people who are in other minorities that are strongly discriminated against, Native Americans, for example, for people of other religions, for people who have fallen through the bottom of the social safety net economically, for people living in Appalachia, even if they're, you know, white. To them, I suspect that a lot of this is just going to sound like happy talk, you know, rich white folks talking to each other about, you know, can we make this world better? We saw in the 1960s and 70s here in the United States these terrible riots. We've been discussing this on this program. It's going on in France right now.
Right.
What do you bring to the table? What do you see as something that, you know, what do you think brought that about, and how could your vision help prevent that from happening here in the United States as time goes on?
Right. I mean, ultimately, the new dream that we're talking about is not just about changing consumption, although I would argue strongly that there are ways we consume differently that are going to be very empowering for low-income people, not just rich white people. But your point's well taken. For us to be safe in the long haul and to have a sustainable economy, we have to have a level of a public safety net where everyone has a certain level of material security and from that can feel safe. There is no question. So if we just talk about people consuming differently, that is not the whole solution. It's got to be paired. We do have to change the way things are made. The federal government is not regulating corporations to require them to harvest or manufacture things differently. So the way we are getting corporations to change, for the most part, is through campaigns that align socially responsible investors with socially responsible consumers. There is a role for that, but it is not the whole story. It's not the whole dream.
Yeah, and it doesn't always work. I can tell you, you know, a little bit of retirement money that I have, we put into one of these socially responsible funds some years ago, and it went south real fast.
Well, of course, you can probably find any number of people who've had their money go south real fast with conventional funds.
Sure.
I'm not here to defend social responsible investing.
No, but my point is, you know, I think that's all well and good, but it's, and you know, as an investing, you know, that's fine and all that, but still, ultimately, we're going to have to use the force of government, are we not?
Oh, we will. And that's why, as I say, you know, ultimately, we need to build a political base in this country which goes beyond the already converted that we currently have, that does span all those people that you just described, people of color, people in rural communities, people in urban communities, who see some common values that they share and who see some common vision for our country.
Mm-hmm.
It's about greater fairness, where we share our resources, and where there's a certain, where government policies are established that provide things like a national health care and a basic access to education, the kinds of things that we're losing. So I completely agree with you, but I think it's too simplistic to then dismiss those who are, let's say, economically in a position to buy differently, to somehow dismiss that as a white elite movement. those people are playing a very constructive role in trying to change corporate America.
I'm not dismissing it. But what I'm saying is that corporate America is always going to basically be playing by the rules to the extent that they have to, and that we define the rules. And as long as, you know, the Supreme Court has ruled that a corporation must maximize profits, otherwise your senior officers are not exercising fiduciary responsibility, that they must maximize profits, that as long as that's the case, the profit is the number one thing, and that the rules, the rules of the game of business, that is the laws established
right,
by government,
right.
You know, don't require them to behave in a socially responsible way. They'll throw a bone to you from time to time, or to us, you know. But you know, I mean, you know, the local Walmart is putting in a park, you know, that kind of thing.
No, I'm actually in complete agreement, although I think that I might take a slightly different emphasis, which is I agree completely that ultimately we have to have rules that set the terms of the debate and set the terms of corporate behavior. But the truth is, you know, I think you would probably agree, is that the power to set those rules has not been with us since since 1980. Those who believe in a fair playing ground and believe in greater corporate accountability have not been prevailing. We have not been able to build the power to set those rules. We are, you know, many, many groups, including the Center for an American Dream, have been part of trying to build that. In the short term, though, great damage is being done all over the place
mm-hmm.
with Walmarts.
Sure.
And Walmart's a great example. Walmart is an example where there is a market-based campaign of investors and consumers and low-income people and labor all working to say, if government's not going to make a change, we are. We're going to
yeah.
make it. And it's affecting Walmart's behavior.
Well, I think that's great. I think it's a great start. And we need to get elected officials who will say, enough already.
I'm with you. I'm
okay.
with you 100%.
All righty. Betsy Taylor, newdream.org, right?
That's right.
Newdream.org, Center for a New American Dream. Thanks so much for being with us. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
They say that Richard Corey owns one half of this whole town with political connections to spread his wealth around. Born into society, a bank. He had everything a man could want, power, great desire.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MACS, 1-800-511-MAX for the latest iPods, all things Macintosh, all things computer for that matter. Their website, smalldog.com. Welcome back to our program. I have a dear old friend who has lived in France for many years and lived in the United States for a while, was back in France, and is now living outside of France, but just in the last year, and neither in the U.S. or France. And I sent him a note earlier saying, you know, what do you make of these things, of these riots in France? What's your take on what's going on there? And he sent me back a very, very thoughtful note in which he pointed out that the French riots were the result of failed immigration policies, which is not the same thing that happened in the United States, although you could say the riots in the United States were the result of failed slavery policies. I suppose, which would be a variation on immigration. But his point, my friend's point, he said in those heady days, this was back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, early 80s even, in those heady days when every European had a job, North Africans, Turks, and others were welcomed with open arms to do the menial jobs Europeans disdained. High-rise, low-rent apartment buildings were constructed in every big city of France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Belgium to house, to name a few. They were, of course, ghettos, built on the outskirts of these cities, and there the immigrants were first simply ignored. Later, as economic times got tough, the immigrants were to become the victims of open public scorn and blatant governmental neglect. I have to say, when I lived in Germany, I saw this with the Turkish guest workers who lived basically in ghettos and who had, you know, been welcomed to the open arms in the 50s and 60s to help rebuild Germany. You know, immigrants in Turkey, they came, they had children, their children were German citizens. Now you've got a whole generation of German citizens who look like they're Turkish rather than look like they're the Aryan Germans, and the Germans are discriminating against them on the basis of race. And there's a ghettoization, and there's a, you know, the kind of glass ceiling phenomena. You know, they're only going to rise to certain levels in businesses and things. So anyhow, my friend, he continues, he says, Islamic fundamentalists stepped in where social programs were missing. And here again, perhaps we have a big, you know, clue to all this and how it's working. And offering everything from daycare to policing of entire housing projects. A fissure between disenfranchised, untrained, unemployed youths and government turned into a powder keg waiting for a match. A brilliant, brilliant assessment of what's going on in Europe. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And is it Audine in Seaside, California?
Yes, it is. Hi.
Hey, Audine. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you.
What's up?
Well, I have a comment. I think that I'm probably in the majority with regard to the way these riots are viewed. I have no sympathy for any sort of rioting. And I'm wondering about, you know, as he said, the match that was struck. This was obviously something waiting to happen, but the way I see it is if people are constant, or, you know, if they are coming to another country and they're not assimilating and they're thinking that lawlessness is going to get them what they want, it's not going to work because we've seen it happen here. I remember the Watts riots. I was young, very young at the time. And I saw a certain amount of goodwill, diminished because of the lawlessness that went on. And now, you know, we've still got racism, et cetera, which racism will always exist.
But I'll tell you, at the time of the Watts riots, Audine, if you were African American, you would never rise to the level of chief of police or member of the city council.
I am African American, and I'm very well aware of that. And I'm very much aware of the dearth of leadership in the African American or these the populations that cause these problems, the demagogues that come to fore. The way I see it, black people in America, and I imagine these people over there in the France, absolutely are simply refusing to come into the 21st century to change their ways. They're holding on to these old, inefficient cultural models that do themselves no good. I mean, just the horror of the genital female mutilation.
But that's not widespread in France, is it?
They carry that practice over there. They've had to pass laws to keep those people from
doing that,
butchering their children. I mean, but you see, this sort of thing is what plants a seed within the minds of the general population that there's something wrong. There's just a problem. And the thing of it is that their own culture
Audine, I have another question I'd like to ask you. Can you hold on for a second? We have to take
course,
a break here.
Yes, I will.
The realities of commercial radio, you know, from time to time we have to pay the bills.
I
appreciate it. Let me put you on hold. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's a Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting. Well, as much as we can pull together, anyway.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And we've been talking about Paris burning and France burning and burnings that have happened here in the United States. Audine, thank you for holding on. I'm gonna get back to your call in just a moment, but first, David, you got to put that call on hold. I'm not showing that it's on hold. I'm showing that the phone is locked up. It won't go on hold. Oh, how weird. We have a call from Paris that, here, we can try it. I'm going to try mixing it on this end. Hey, Joe?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, we have a call. Audine, we're going to get to your call in just a second. Joe in Paris, France on the line. Hey, Joe.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Great. So you've been listening, I assume, on the web stream.
Yeah, I just happened to listen on the web stream, and there was a caller that was making a comment about the problems and how here in Paris and how they were in some ways connected to what she thought was the assimilation and the inability of people to assimilate to life in the 20th and 21st centuries. And I think that that's completely beside the point in this case.
There is reality to that, is there not, though? I mean, you do
there
have people living in a very real way as kind of a society apart from society.
Yes, but I really don't think that that's the problem here. The problem, there is a large immigrant community in Paris, in France, and it's been growing since the war, and everything you said about this population, you know, being willing to work for the jobs that the French didn't want to work for, and the same sort of thing mirrored in other European countries is absolutely true. But the violence that we're seeing right now is not a question. It's really not a question of a group of young people unwilling to assimilate. We have high unemployment, and it falls particularly hard on the immigrant communities and the suburbs that ring Paris,
mm-hmm.
and these people really do want to assimilate. I think the ones that I know, and I know lots of people in this situation, but the trouble is that it's difficult to do with the economic climate at the moment, and the problem, specifically this issue, is connected with the fact that the police and the gendarmes and the CRS, the national police, are particularly they put the screws on for identity checks and pressure on these people all the time. It's really a question of harassment. You can see it. I see it in the metro. You know, once every 2 weeks, young people hauled aside and their papers asked for. And apparently, this happens again and again and again. It's not a question of female genital mutilation. It's not a question of the headscarves. It's not that at all. It's specifically tied, I believe, to the fact that these people, that it's just difficult for people to manage in this kind of economic climate, and they are being harassed by the police.
So really, what it gets down to, in your opinion, is the question. I believe it was Wendell Berry who wrote an essay. I could be wrong. It might have been his brother Thomas who wrote an essay maybe 20 years ago about what do you do with the slaves when they're no longer needed as slaves. And this is what has happened in Europe, or in France, where they invited all these immigrants in from these countries that they had formerly conquered to do menial work. And now they're not saying you can become part of the general society. In fact, if anything, they're discriminating against them in a very, frankly, aggressive way. At least that's what I saw with the Turks in Germany when I lived in Germany. And these people are saying, hey, wait a minute, we'd like to be part of society. And I think in America, when African Americans said that in the 60s and 70s, hey, wait a minute, you know, now after Brown versus Board of Education and the Civil Rights Act, we want to be part of society. The rest of American society, or the white part of American society, said, okay, cool, to at least some percentage of it, enough of a critical mass, but that's not happening in France.
No, well, the it is true that the vast majority, it seems to me, do want to assimilate. They don't want to return to North Africa.
They want to become French. They may want to keep their Islamic religion. They may want to keep, you know, some of their traditions and ways.
Oh, sure.
But they want to become French. They want to speak French. They want to think of.
This isn't the problem. And what your friend, the comment that your longtime friend mentioned about the glass ceiling is absolutely true. This I hear again and again. It's not one of the things that we see here. It's the subtle form of racism that we're not used to in the States in the same way. It's mm-hmm. understated. It's not as blatant and as violent as what we get used to. But there's that, and then there's also the younger, it's the generation that wants to find some sort of a living, some sort of a job. They've been in the university. They can't find work. And
now they can't find work because of the color of their skin.
There's probably some of that. I mean, it's. You know, obviously that exists to some extent, but that's a problem that is that's particularly hard in these communities because there's such a concentration of immigrants in certain communities, certain suburban communities around Paris. And but to assume that the problem is one that's fundamentally one connected with assimilation is completely off the mark. The vast majority of people, I do believe, do want to assimilate here, and they speak a fine French, and they are integrated into the schools.
Let me bring Audine in, who was in Seaside, California, who was you're speaking of, who was just offering the suggestion. Audine, is this making sense to you?
Not really. I mean, I've heard this argument here in the United States that, well, there's always going to be discrimination. The Jews were discriminated against for years and years in Europe, and of course they eventually, a lot of them, immigrated other places and built a great society. The fact is that these people that think that lawlessness is, that their lawlessness is justified, it's never justified. This is the excuse you hear over and over and over again all the way through to the 1991 riots in Los Angeles when I was there. And yet they, you know, and I would say that, just to digress, this is the watershed era for that country. I feel that they're probably going to face even more discrimination now because of this behavior. And I think that one of the, in my view, that the leadership, if there is any, should start to stress that despite, no matter what the discrimination, it's always going to exist, lawlessness is not going to get you anywhere. But also, I just think that whenever overall we have, the people have the feeling that people really don't want to assimilate. They want to take the cream, but they don't, you know, they don't want to do the anything else. I think that they're going to have to stress education in their ranks, orderliness, and coming together in some perhaps a new form of an economic neighborhood economic situation, et cetera. But I just decry that in the United States, and I'm a black person as well, that somehow the law, they're giving these their children over several generations, and I've seen it, that lawlessness, that their lawlessness is justified, and it's
Joe,
not.
Joe, what's your response
to that? I mean, obviously, the lawlessness is a, the lawless group is a small group within a group that feels that feels discriminated against, and particularly.
Joe, if I can interrupt, how long have you been in Paris?
I've been 23 years I've been here.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm a permanent resident at this point. My question to the other caller, whose name I can't recall, excuse me,
Audine.
Has she ever lived abroad? Has she lived in Europe? Has she lived in a place where the
well, I don't think we need to get into
dynamic is different.
Personal stuff here. I'm not sure that
excuse
that's going to be productive.
No, but I mean it's the one thing is that you can't compare the way people deal with these questions in the States in the same way that
in other words, what you're saying, Joe, is that the situation there is so different than the United States that for Americans to try to understand it is not possible unless they've gone over there and hung out and seen it. And is that what you're saying?
I say that there's a it's just different. It's not something that living over here and interacting with the people on a daily basis, and the neighborhood I live in is very, very integrated. It's culturally very diverse. It is different than and the dynamic is different from what you expect from what you would find in the States. You cannot apply the same models and the same analyses and come up with any sort of a valid assessment of what's going on here. The truth is the truth is that there is a desire to assimilate. I know that for a fact. I can see this all the time. And the trouble is that the racism that does exist here and the catalyst for this particular event was.
Well, I mean, you have Le Pen. I mean, you actually have kind of an official racist political party there, don't you, in France?
Oh, sure. I mean, they're not. They,
I mean, it would be the equivalent of George Wallace having a large political party here in the United States.
It's not a large political party. It's a marginalized political party. It's pretty much a consistent 8 to 12%. They're
8 to 12%
it's understandable. They're not somebody. Even the people who are on the conservative side of the political spectrum will eschew and will this group. They're embarrassed by them, and
embarrassed by the racists among them.
Embarrassed by the racist and the racism and the and the political discourse that comes from them during times of election.
Okay, we only have about a minute left.
Can I interject something?
Sure, Audine, go for it.
Yeah, I'll just leave with two questions. What do they expect to gain by this lawlessness? That's what I would ask any group, whether they're in the United States, in Europe,
or the rioters.
That's the major question. I mean, he can put the fine edger on it however he wants, but there's somehow that
Joe, happens. What do you think? We have 30 seconds left. Joe,
well,
what do you think?
The rioters are just having their it's their anger they're not hoping to get anything. They're not even thinking. It's just random violence. The problem isn't the rioters. The problem is the thing that we have to think about are the communities that from which the rioters are.
Yeah, well, the leadership, and there's apparently is a dearth of leadership, and I imagine that there's a good deal of demagoguery, just as there is in the United States with the.
Is this organized, Joe? Are there leaders in this?
No, I don't believe so.
Subtext is that you can do whatever.
Just random violence.
Yeah.
Because you've been discriminated.
Audine, thank you for your comments and for calling. I appreciate it. Joe, thank you for your comments and for calling all the way from Paris, France, to the program.
Good to talk with you, Tom.
Much appreciated. We'll continue this conversation after this break. It's 45 and a half minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Come on and take a walk with me through this green and growing land. Walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand. Walk through the valleys
and welcome
and
back,
the
my friends. 9.5 minutes
walk
before the top of the hour. It's Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of by and for we, the people of the United States. Grant in Arcata, California, you're live and on the air. Hey, Grant, what's up?
I thought a good friend of mine was there in 65 when those riots, and he told me, I don't doubt
it. There where?
In Watts.
Oh, okay.
It was the very first black uprising in the United States against the police brutality. And I believe that that's what's happening in Europe, too, in France, that these people of color are tired of being picked on, you know, picked on like they're being picked on. You know, the scrutiny they're under is tremendous. And nothing's going to change until they either get a lot of black policemen there that are sensitive to these people or you know, people of color. But that this is the children are just that these are the ones that have the most rage in them, and they don't know what else to do. It's an act of desperation on their part. And
so you think it's just people saying enough is enough?
Enough is enough. Yeah. That was the first riot in 65. Was the first time in America's history the blacks rose up against the police. They were just tired of being abused by them. And they, you know, those neighborhoods always become training grounds for police to learn how to behave.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree with you, Grant. I'm old enough to say that I grew up at a time when I was born in 1951. So as a child, I grew up in a segregated country, and you know, I remember seeing, you know, traveling around the country as a child, and even in Michigan, in a few places, you know, whites only signs, certainly we had segregated. Segregated water fountains, segregated schools, segregated swimming. The swimming pool in town was simply not available. Not, you know, if you were black, you couldn't go there. So apparently not anywhere near as bad as it is in France. Although, who knows? Carla in Sacramento, California. Carla, you're live and on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to kind of agree with some things that were said while I was waiting on the line here. One thing, France is essentially a homogeneous country. It's white, it's French, and it's Catholic.
Or it has been.
Well, I mean, even if people are not very Catholic or whatever, now there's this this immigrant population, what's being called immigrant population, that's about 12%. And so the French composition is very different from that in the United States, where we have lots of ethnicities, lots of languages, lots of religions, et cetera.
Well, in a way, though, I mean, you know, the African-American population is I believe, what, 17-18% in the United States? So it's not that different from that 12% immigrant population in France. And I think that, you know, we were treating America, all of, you know, the nation, we were treating African-Americans very poorly. And we still have a long way to go, frankly, in my opinion.
Oh, sure.
And so it seems actually like you're making the argument that there's more parallels than differences.
Well, Yes, but to understand it, you have to really understand that they're much more homogeneous than we've ever been.
Mm.
So there's lots less receptivity to differences. But my
well, point in, you know, in our early years, we had this myth of we were white Protestant, and you know, and yeah, and I mean the Catholic Irish and Italian immigrants who came to the East Coast of the United States were terribly discriminated against and ghettoized in the early 1800s through Reconstruction through the late 1800s. The Asians who came to the United States, to the West Coast of the United States, to help build the railroad, terribly discriminated against. I mean, we have a long history of doing exactly what France has done, apparently. Not to mention, I mean, the god-awful thing of, you know, 300 years of slavery in this country.
Sure. I was comparing United States now with France now, not the whole history of how we got to where we are. But my point has to do really with the colonies.
Mm-hmm.
The French had these places where these people have come from, and we're calling them immigrants, but they've been in France three and four generations. So really,
they're French citizens.
They're French citizens, and their parents have been French citizens, and maybe their grandparents have been French citizens. But when the French went over to those places, they took their language, they took their way of life, and they stayed in little enclaves, and they told the populations there, you be like us. And independence in those places was very violent because the French wouldn't let go. And there are vestiges of that in this whole thing.
Yeah.
But now the populations from those colonies are in France, and while they want to keep some aspects of their culture, they basically want to mainstream.
Yeah, so it's empire fighting back. And Carl, I appreciate your comment. Well said. I want to get a couple other folks in here before we have to run, and we've got about a minute and a half. Marjorie in Sacramento.
Oh, hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
I just wanted to say it really is sad to me that to hear the apathy and the lack of hope in Audine's comments. Coming from an African-American woman, that it just really struck me to the heart, you know, calling, you know, Turks or French Moors or French Muslims, calling them immigrants is like calling people from New Orleans refugees.
Well, I don't think that she meant it that way, Marjorie. I have to say in her defense, I didn't get that message from it. And, although I can see where... I'm not sure. Pam in Sammamish, Washington. Hey, Pam, we have a minute.
Okay.
A little less than a minute.
All right. Well, I'll try to take to heart the admonition from the gentleman from Paris not to try to play out our concepts of things over there too much. But just sitting back observing this, I know that poverty has a lot to do with many things that occur like this, and it's gone on for centuries, of course. But I just kind of wondered if perhaps some of the economic forces, the global economic forces that we're all experiencing, you know, multinationally.
Well, yeah, and
multinationals
this
has a lot to do with this. And if maybe, I mean,
it
if
does,
you think
Pam.
About it, the riots here in the 60s actually created this huge backlash with Reagan.
Yeah.
And we're still suffering from that. And you wonder if there are forces that actually have helped to precipitate this.
Sure. And I'll tell you what it is, Pam, and thank you very much for the call. It is globalization, and it's also Europeanization, you know, the EU. What you have is you have these former Soviet countries coming into the EU bloc and essentially cheap labor now taking a lot of jobs out of France. And so France suddenly, you know, is having this terrible unemployment problem. Their economy is going into the tank. The same is happening with all the highly developed countries. It's the same that will happen here as CAFTA continues. And the people who are at the bottom of the economic ladder are saying, in my opinion, are saying, enough already. Enough. So anyway, this is a conversation we'll continue. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just received another note. This Joe, of course, called us from Paris in the last hour. This is an email I received from Paris. I want to share this with you in just a minute. Also, we've got a few other calls, Aaron in Carbondale, Illinois, and others talking about these this issue of what's going on in France. We'll get back to that in just a second. Our telephone number, by the way, 1-866-440-8466. 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. But first, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. has a report for us about what's going on in the belly of the beast. Hey, Victoria.
Well, yes, Tom, actually, I just came out of the belly after a briefing with Scott McClellan.
Oh, really?
Helen Thomas was on her game today.
God bless her.
I mean, she wasn't the only one. David Gregory of NBC did a good job, too. But she started off about torture. She wanted a definition, and she wanted to know what Cheney was up to, basically, in terms of lobbying to get an exemption for the CIA when we're told that the CIA don't torture. So this went on for some considerable time. I ultimately asked, because he eventually said that you have to ask the vice president's office, so I ultimately asked, so are you saying that the vice president's office is operating independently from the president's office? Is that why you can't answer questions about what the vice president's doing?
And he said?
Well, I mean, he did. You'll be astonished to hear this, Tom. He did not answer me directly.
Oh, really?
Yes, not directly. He subjected me to a very long answer about the war in Iraq and American foreign policy, which I allowed him to go on, but I kept sort of interrupting by saying, this doesn't really help me. Ultimately, I did not get an answer to that question.
So it may be that Scotty is trying to say that Dick Cheney's running his own show separate from George W. Bush.
And judging by the piece in today's Daily News, you know, that is something that we have to wonder about, but he would not say that.
What's the piece in today's Daily News?
I also asked questions about the ethics lessons.
Okay. Go ahead.
I also asked questions about the remedial ethics classes that they're having to take.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, we were told that Andy Card and Harriet Myers were the ones who came up with the idea along with the president, and Karl Rove was not involved in planning the classes. Not entirely surprised about that.
Yeah.
But attendance is mandatory for everybody.
Now, what was the piece in the Daily News? You said the Daily News there was a piece? I missed this.
Yes, there's a piece in the Daily News, very interesting piece, which talks about how the biggest kept secret is by Thomas DeFrank. Basically, that the biggest kept secret in the White House is that there is some distance between Cheney and Bush now. They're calling it the subtle but unmistakable erosion in the bonds between them. Apparently, they are not close in the same way that they used to be.
Yeah. George has found, you know, my sense of it was that during his first term, George W. Bush really very much never felt comfortable being president or exercising the power of the presidency. That he was more like, you know, a little kid playing at being something than actually being something. And that before Katrina, but after the election, he started feeling like, hey, maybe I really am the president. Like, you know, through the first 4 years, there was always this little voice that said, my daddy's appointees to the Supreme Court made me president, and I'm not really the president. And so he relied very heavily on Dick Cheney and others around him, kind of leaned on them. And I think that after the election, he mistakenly, in my opinion, believed that the people of the United States actually voted for him and elected him to be president, and that he actually did have a mandate. In fact, I think that his disastrous Social Security promotional tour is a demonstration, his overreaching is a demonstration of how deluded he was into believing that he actually had a mandate and that the people of America, you know, wanted him as president and loved him and all that kind of thing. And that would cause him to figure that he doesn't need to lean on these guys as much. Am I engaging in psychobabble here?
No, I think you're making total sense. The belief that he expressed himself that he has earned capital and he intends to spend it, and he did start spending that capital on Social Security, which, by the way, was one of Karl Rove's boondoggles.
Yeah, and that's going down in flames. Fascinating.
Yes.
Victoria Jones,
yes.
Just finally, anything out of the White House about the situation in Paris?
No, nothing really. I mean, there were a couple of questions asked, and quite honestly, I didn't hear what the answers were, so I can't tell you. If I told you, I might be giving you a falsehood.
What's conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C. about what's going on in France and why?
That it's really, really scary and we should probably be worried, even though we don't have a similar situation here, but that the last thing we need is for it to spread to other countries. And the real fear in Washington is that it will.
So that it's really, really scary. It seems like anything that comes out of this administration has to be really, really scary. You realize that nobody has died in any of these riots.
No, the one 60-year-old guy wasn't there. That was not in the riot. That was after a riot.
Right. Nobody has died.
Right.
As far as I can tell, nobody's even been seriously wounded. Some police officers got shot in the butt with birdshot, and specifically in the butt. And some cars got burned. And I'm not minimizing this, but it seems that and the Muslim community has come out and issued a formal fatwa against the violence. Has come out and said, most of the rioters, by the way, are between 10 and 14 years old.
Right, and apparently there is this bizarre situation where you've got older brothers trying to stop their younger brothers from committing the violence. There is very much an age differential on this.
Yeah, so we have a bunch of kids run amok here, and for this, the United States State Department is saying don't travel to France?
Well, you know, I mean, they were saying that for a while anyway because of Freedom Fries. It is absurd, and I would suggest that anybody who can get a cheap flight, this is probably the time to go.
Yeah, I would say so. Victoria Jones, thanks a lot for the report. Good to hear
Thank
from you.
Thank you very
much. And Victoria, before you... Oh, she's gone. Okay. I was going to ask her one other question, but life goes on. Aaron in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. thanks for having me on. Hello?
Glad to have you here, and thanks for listening to WINI. What's up?
Yes. I think the important question to ask when it comes to the riots in France is if there's over 20% unemployment among immigrants in France, why does the government continue to have such a liberal immigration policy there?
Well, this is where it gets confusing, because these people that we're referring to as immigrants, most of them actually are not immigrants. They, you know, I mean, my grandfather, my father's father, and my father's mother both came to the United States from Norway in like 1917. My mother's parents, my mother's relatives, first came here in the late 1600s. I've got like both, right? But by the definitions that are being used in American reporting, I'm an immigrant.
Well, sir, when people came over to the United States back then, a long time ago, at the same time as my family came over in the 20s, I mean, my family came over here to pick cotton. You know, so and nowadays there is no need for massive amounts of unskilled labor coming to America.
Right.
That's why I think the same question is applicable here. Why, if the wages of the working class is falling every year, why is Bush pushing the massive amnesty program that he is?
Well, again, there's that very delicate threshold that they have to maintain. But the bottom line, ultimately, of course, in France and in the United States, is all about cheap labor. It's all about cheap labor. That what you have in France is a situation where they were importing cheap labor for generations. And a lot of these, as I said, virtually all of these kids who are rioting are not actually immigrants. They are the children of the children of immigrants, or the children, the grandchildren, the great grandchildren, the great 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 grandchildren of immigrants. Most of the French immigration happened in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. Well, not the 40s, but the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. You know, particularly very heavily, if the French immigration patterns follow those of Germany, which I'm very familiar with because I lived there, it was immediately after World War II, and they needed a lot of labor to rebuild, and a lot of the men of those countries were dead from the war, and so they brought in immigrants from North Africa to help rebuild the country. Well, those people had children and grandchildren. Now we're two generations down the road from 1950 to 1945, 1947, 48, 49, and so these people aren't immigrants. They're French citizens.
So what you're saying is it's not an immigrants riot, but it's a race riot.
That's exactly right. That's my point. And for some reason, the American media persists in calling people immigrants simply because they have dark skin.
I think maybe that's because they're afraid to approach the topic of race in this issue.
I don't know. It could be simply because Americans tend to be and our media tends to be wildly uninformed. The other day, I hear this radio station. There's five radio stations that run out of this one building here where I'm working. And I was in the restroom during a break the other day, and they got Rush Limbaugh in the restroom. And he's complaining about, Dan Rather complaining about the fact that CBS News closed all these international bureaus. And he's essentially saying, Americans don't need to be informed about the rest of the world. A network doesn't have to have bureaus. I mean, they should be worrying about their profitability, not whether or not they're informing people. That's their job, is to be profitable. And I mean, it's that kind kind of mentality that has led to the incredible dumbing down of the American public, and, you know, here we are. So, anyhow, Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. Good point and interesting. This is that delicate line that they're dancing. It's the exact same thing Bush is doing with his immigration policy. Bring people into the United States and drive down the cost of labor. The French wanted to bring people in to rebuild France, but then, you know, it was driving down the cost of labor. Worked for the corporations. It's not working for the country. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So you spin to the right, then spin to the right, then spin to the right again. Then you spin clockwise, spin to the starboard, spin to the right, and then you move a little bit abrupter. You're our nation's finest interrupter.
And welcome back, my
yours
friends.
Is the last word and first word.
Yes, it's the old O'Reilly. In fact, pop that back up again.
Oh, I put the bull in bully.
Oh, really?
No, O'Reilly.
Yeah, there we go. Welcome back. Nancy Anton is with us. Anton, that's what I thought. Nancy Anton is with us with NewsHounds.us. They watch Fox. They watch Fox, so we don't have to. In fact, your slogan, we watch Fox, so you don't have to. And God bless you for doing a difficult job. Nancy Anton, the website, by the way, newshounds.us, I discovered this morning newshounds.org will get you there as well.
Yes, but US is the preferred, the easier one, the prime one.
Yeah, it's the official one. In fact, if you hit org, it just bounces you over to it, so that's fine.
Yeah.
Fox is linking the riots in France with a great Ramadan offensive. A what?
Right. Operation Steel Curtain.
We're supposed to be terrified because here are the statistics. This is from the BBC. 5,873 cars have been torched, 1,500 people arrested, 17 people sentenced, 120 police and firefighters injured as of November 8th, one person killed. A few cops got birdshot in their butts. This doesn't seem to me. I mean, this is nothing. I don't mean it's literally nothing at all.
No,
but
relatively speaking, you're
right.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, we had riots in the United States. People died. It's we're a little more well armed than France, but you look at, you know, I mean, riots in many other countries of the world. Why is this? Is Fox going off on some kind of wild fear campaign around this?
Well, it's partly because, you know, the Hate the French campaign, the ongoing. Hate the French.
Right.
It's also good eye candy. There's, you know, great videos of things going up in flames and people running around at night, you know.
Yeah, if it bleeds, it leads.
Exactly.
Yeah, so this is good tabloid journalism.
Package. They're also able to play the law and order card.
Mm-hmm.
For example, today Bill Hemmer was going on about, have they called in the army and why not? You know, the French so far have chosen not to call in the army.
Right.
They're using the police.
Right.
But Fox is starting already. They should be calling out the army. They should be shooting people on sight. You know, the same thing we saw in New Orleans.
So preparing Americans or conditioning Americans for the idea that a police state is a desirable thing.
Oh, absolutely.
A police state will keep you safe.
It's the only thing that will keep you safe.
Well, there really was very little crime in Hitler's Germany after 1936 or 37.
Well, again, it depends on how you define safe.
And it depends on how you define crime, I guess. If genocide is a crime, I guess there was an enormous amount of crime. But I'm talking, you know, the street crime. It's a, yeah. So Fox's idea, apparently, of a safe society and an orderly society is very much like German society in the late 30s.
Yeah.
It seems. And George W. Bush, a latter-day Millard Fillmore? Tell me about this.
Well, I'm not...
I don't think most Americans even realize that Millard Fillmore was ever president.
Or exactly. Millard who?
Right.
Well, that's a financial comparison, apparently.
How so?
I wasn't quite clear on it myself, but it was made on Forbes, on Fox, you know, that Saturday morning block that they have of
sure.
financial shows.
All their financial shows, yeah.
And it seemed a little bit ludicrous. I mean, talk about scraping the bottom of the barrel for comparison.
Well, what I thought was particularly interesting was that you noted in your blog that, all of the Fox financial shows basically obsess on how George W. is doing. And if he's doing well, they say, well, George W. is doing well, it's going to be a good week for the markets. And if he's doing poorly, they say, George W. is doing poorly, it's going to be a bad week for the markets. The implicit message being, if you want to have economic safety and security, shut up and support the president.
Well, yes, that's true. Also, their economic shows, for example, Cavuto, which is the daily one,
right.
As opposed to the weekend block. It's supposed to be like the biggest economic show, business show, and they discuss very little business.
Yeah.
Their guests are all politicians. Well, not all, excuse me, but largely politicians. It's politics. It's not business.
Yeah, well, that's what Fox is all about, is hustling politics. Have there been any, Nancy Anton with FunNewsHounds.us, have there been any cracks in the wall, as it were, in terms of getting Roger Ailes' daily memos out to the public?
No.
We all hear about this, you know, every day or on most days, the memo comes down from Roger saying, this is our theme for the day, here are our talking points for the day, and everybody, you know, lines up and echoes the exact same thing all day long, by and large.
I think they've got a pretty good lockdown on their system.
Yeah, they've got a very good internal security there, apparently.
Right, right.
Well,
we need a mole.
Yeah, it's that orderly society. And now they've got a new sexual harassment lawsuit. This one after O'Reilly settled his with Andrea Macris.
Right.
Another one. We're just about out of time here. This is Kim Weiler and Joe Cimilli. I'm not sure who these folks are, but we'll just see how this plays out.
It'll be very interesting. Of course, they haven't mentioned it on air.
Yeah, of course, of course. Nancy Anton with NewsHounds.us. They watch Fox, so you don't have to. Thanks for the report, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Great talking with you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour. The radio support group of, by, and for We the People.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 34 and a half minutes past the hour. It's interesting. Some of the folks in the chat room, hi, guys. Hi, everybody there. Some of the folks in the chat room are, you know, why is Tom talking about France? Why are we going off on this thing? Why should Tom be creating a diversion? Isn't it more important to be talking about how George Bush was badly treated badly received, rather, in South America, in Argentina and all that sort of thing, or about the Scooter Libby or the Karl Rove or the indictments and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, all those things are important, and we'll be coming back to all those things. But I'll tell you why I think this is important, why I think what's going on right now in France is important, because it is coming soon to a TV near you. And by that, I mean, I'm telling you, lay this down as a prediction. And the folks in the chat room, hold me accountable for this. And I know you will. You will see that in all probability in the elections of 2006, and certainly in the elections of 2008, the issues of immigration and race will become big issues. And by and large, the race part of it is going to have to do with Hispanic versus, whereas, you know, 30, 40 years ago in the U.S., there was issues of race of black and white. And you're already seeing it. You've seen it, you know, this guy, he wants to build a fence across Mexico. They are pandering to the racists among us. And that is the way that Fox News and many of the other national media are spinning this thing in France. And I see this, and I don't mean this as in some kind of, you know, grand conspiracy theory way. I think it's really kind of accidentally bumbling into it backwards in terms of the American news media. But certainly I think the political strategists, you can plug grand conspiracy theory into this. I see this as they're testing the water. How do the American people react to this? What can be used to make the American people more fearful? What can cause Americans, both white and black, to be more afraid of some other minority group? We've already got them terrified about the Muslims. Now can we get them terrified about the Mexicans? Can we create this? Can we create a thing around immigration? Can we? I'm telling you, Bush, and ultimately, it's all about benefiting corporate power. It's all about driving down the cost of labor and providing for cheap labor. And in a very healthy, very strong, very vital, very vibrant economy, the bottom end of the labor pool is still doing well enough that they'll go to work every day and say, hey, cool. But when the economy starts to go in the tank because of globalization, which is exactly what's happening in France, and it's not so much globalization that's hitting France and Germany and the United Kingdom, and the developed Italy, the developed, in quotes, countries of Europe. It's not so much globalization as it is bringing into the European Union the former Soviet states, the poorer countries, where now you have, instead of a French citizen working for the U.S. equivalent of $20 an hour, competing with a French citizen who's willing to work for the U.S. equivalent of $16 an hour. You have a French citizen working for $20 or $16 an hour, now has to compete with a Romanian or somebody from Latvia or Lithuania or a Pole who might be willing to work for $4 an hour. And what's happening is that the big, large corporations are shutting down factories in France and moving them to the former Soviet republics, where labor is cheaper. And there's concern. I mean, there's talk about let's expand it to Turkey. Let's bring Turkey into the EU. And there's all this talk about that. And the corporations are like, cool. You know, when the standard of living starts getting up to the point where Latvia and Lithuania and I don't have a list of the former Soviet countries that have actually been admitted to the EU. I may be misnaming countries, but you get the point that, when the standard of living in Poland rises to a certain point where it's not cheap labor, then we'll bring in Turkey. And we'll have a whole new pool of cheap labor. From the Zbigniew Brzezinski standpoint, from the grand chessboard standpoint, it's all about cheap labor. And from the political standpoint, it's all about manipulating cheap labor in ways that allow you to keep political power and ultimately, in my opinion, ultimately strengthen the consensus for the need for a police state. And this is what's playing out in France right now, and I'm telling you, you're going to see it playing out in the United States. And not necessarily the riots, but the model, the paradigm. Over the next, at the very, in all possibility over the next 12 months, in all probability over the next 3 years. I don't think it's a coincidence that Duncan Hunter just came out with his bill to build a wall from sea to sea, from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean to block off Mexico, and that, had that happened, had somebody come out and said that in 1960, they wouldn't have even gotten news coverage. Everybody would have laughed at them. Come on, give me a break. What are you talking about? Build a wall. But in 1960, we had strong labor unions. We had a strong economy. We were enforcing laws against illegal immigrants working here in the United States, and corporations had to, reluctantly, but they had to pay a living wage. In 1960, you had 70% of the American labor force was working at the kind of job where you had full health benefits, a pension, retirement. You were able to put your kids through school, and with one person working, you could own a home, you could own a car, and take vacations. Because 35% of the American workforce was unionized. And now we're down to 8% of the private workforce in the United States is unionized. And maybe 15, 20, 25, maybe 30%. It depends on how you define it, of the American workforce has that kind of a job now. And even those are not considered secure. Whereas in 1960, people had a good, solid job. They figured, hey, I'm putting in my 20 years, retire, 25 years, whatever it may be, retire, have a pension, have a good life. Now, even if you have a job where there's a whole retirement plan and everything, you're waiting for them to, you know, say, okay, after how many years before we can fire this person to replace them with somebody, you know, new, so we can start the cycle all over again, so we don't have to pay them retirement benefits. 7 years? Cool. At the end of 6.5 years, fire them. And it's just become the way things are done in the United States. And again, those at the bottom of the economic ladder are the ones who are going to suffer. And in France, it's the people who are the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the immigrants from the African colonies of France. And in the United States, back in the 60s and 70s, it was people who were the great-great-great-great-grandchildren of slaves brought to this country. And now I am predicting the next vilified group is going to be, because in order for the Reich to work, you got to have an enemy. Hitler could not have succeeded if it wasn't for Marius van der Lubbe lighting on fire on February 27, 1933, the Reichstag, the parliament building. You've got to have an enemy. He had to vilify the Jews. He had to vilify the gays. He had to vilify the Catholics. He had to vilify the gypsies. You have to have an enemy if you're gonna have a police state, because you have to protect us all from somebody. And I'm telling you, the next bunch that we're all going to have to be protected from, and it's already starting, that the Reich is cranking this thing up, is going to be those immigrants. And that's why I think this is an important issue. I really do. 1-866-440-8466. The telephone number of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Casey in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Casey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Casey?
I absolutely agree with everything that you're saying. I mean, I can't even imagine having one person work and be able to support a whole family and send kids to school. It seems absolutely like impossible.
Yeah, it is a completely different world than it was, when I was a kid. I mean, and I know that makes me sound like an incredible old fart to say that.
No, it doesn't.
But because I remember when I was a kid, my grandparents were saying, "It ain't the same world it was when I was young." You kids just don't have the respect or whatever. You know, but the reality is that, you know, setting aside cultural things, you know.
That's what I called about.
Okay, go for it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay.
I totally agree. I think this is my own little personal view, but I think that people get race and culture mixed, confused a lot.
Sure.
Because I think just because somebody has a certain skin color, it's like environment and surroundings. So, like, if you took a baby of any race and they're going to adapt to, and, you know, behaviorism, they're going to behave wherever they're raised, whatever their environment is, like a black baby in an Asian family or Asian baby in a Native family, or, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I think that people, especially being a black person raised in, like, a white suburb,
mm-hmm.
And it's funny because when I went to school, I got teased by all the white kids, and then my mother pulled me out and put me in a black school. And I was like, oh, great, you know, now I don't have to deal with, you know, racism, blah, blah. And everybody there was just like, oh, you talk like a white girl. And, you know what I mean? You act like a white person. And I used to tell people, that doesn't make any sense. You can't act white, and you can't talk black. You can, if there's a white kid that has his pants sagging, it doesn't mean that he wants to be black. He may live, you know, white.
So you're saying,
urban.
Casey, it's about culture, not race.
Exactly.
That we should, that's what we should be. And you make such a great point. And we've got to take a break here. But afterwards, I want to just rant on about that for just a second. Casey, thanks so much for calling and making that point.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. And thank you for listening to us there on Talk 1090 in Seattle, Washington. It's 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least a few electoral votes. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, "How do you do?" They're really saying, "I love you."
And Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Telling the truth that the multinational corporation, would really just rather you didn't know about. You know, it's a... And transforming the world by revitalizing democracy one step at a time. Okay, Casey raised the issue of is it race or culture? And I just, this is my take on it, for better or for worse. I've traveled all around the world. I've worked with and lived with, for short periods of time, indigenous people on four continents. For 27 years, I did volunteer relief work. Usually it was in grim circumstances. It was in places like Uganda during the war in 1980, when the Tanzanians invaded to throw out Idi Amin. In Colombia, in the Medellin Valley, when the narco wars were going on there, things like that. But also in places that weren't, you know, in horrible crisis, working in, up in the Lockhart River, community in North Queensland in Australia, with the Aboriginal communities there. And what I've gotten out of this over the years is that, in my opinion, again, always throw this caveat in, that the most foundational hardwired system in us, that there's a certain thing, you know, you can tell the difference between a dog and a cat. I mean, you know, they have different behaviors. There are behaviors that are intrinsic to animals, and humans have a particular behavior, and that human behavior, regardless of race, the most powerful and fundamental of the intrinsic human behaviors is to look out for family. Is to organize into family, to protect one's family, and then one step out from that is to organize and protect one's immediate extended family, clan, tribe, neighborhood, community, and then one step up from that is to, you know, one's larger community, and that there is, as an ancient survival mechanism built into our low lizard brain part of us, this part of us that will always notice people who are different than we are. Whether it's if you do travel in Amsterdam in Holland, for example, you notice there's a lot of very tall people there. Or if you travel in Africa, people very, you know, very unique, different colors of skin in different parts of the continent of Africa. Or, well, I can go on and on, but anyhow, the point is, I think that it's just a human thing to notice somebody who's different. Racism is when that noticing is combined with an opinion of superiority and inferiority. And that's something that is learned and that can be unlearned. And I think that all of us are born into essentially a racist culture, and all of us have to work very hard to unlearn the racism that is part of our society, that is part of our... And it's not just racism. There's also sexism that's built into it. I mean, the old Cinderella story, you know, here she is, the good girl is the one who's the basically the maid, and the evil, ugly girls, the two sisters, are the ones who are trying to get something. What are they trying to get? They're trying to get a man. I mean, what is this? And not just a man, a putz of a guy, such a schmuck that he can't even remember what she looks like, her face looks like. He can only remember what her feet look like. The guy's a foot fetishist. And in any case, I mean, these are the stories that make up our culture. So, you know, we can overcome racism to as much of an extent as we can. And I think that all thinking people try to overcome the racism that is intrinsic to just noticing the difference between people. Or the sexism, for that matter, that's intrinsic to that. But I don't think it's possible for us to easily overcome culturism. When I first moved to Germany in 1986, I thought that I was moving to a country that was just like the United States, except they spoke a different language. And if I just learned that language, everything would be fine. And what I discovered was it was a completely different culture. People relate to people differently. I mean, it just, I can tell you stories, but it's just... I don't have time now, but I mean, just trust me. Culture is different from country to country, and American culture is uniquely American culture, and other countries' cultures are unique, and people really and truly do see the world differently, see each other differently, see us differently, understand their position in the world differently, think of themselves in relation to others, think of themselves in relation to the natural world, think of themselves in relation to the economy differently. And culturism is something that is a real challenge, because we it's like a fish trying to know that it's in water. It's like us trying to remember that we're breathing air. You look around you, there's air all around you all the time. You're not even noticing it. That's what culture is. It's the air around you all the time that you don't even realize you're breathing until somebody tries to change it. If somebody puts their hand over your nose for a minute and you can't breathe, all of a sudden air becomes really important. If somebody takes you out of your culture and puts you in a different culture, suddenly you realize, hey, wait a minute, this is really different. I didn't know. And the one extraordinary thing, I think, about American culture is that we've actually been through a series of cultural transformations over the last couple of hundred years. And one of the founding myths of our, positive myths, a desirable myth of our nation, is that our culture is fluid, changeable, and inclusive. And many other countries have as their founding myths that they are them and nobody else can ever be them and nobody else can ever join them. That they are about their particular race or their particular language or their particular land, and that's it, end of discussion. And we have this very inclusive culture. And so I think that, you know, what's incumbent upon all of us is to be aware of that, to notice the cultural filter that we're using when we look at, for example, the reporting from France, or, for that matter, the cultural filter that we're using when we hear people like Duncan Hunter talking about let's have a border across Mexico, and this becomes a big Republican issue in the next two elections, and they try to exploit this the way it was gays before, and it was flag burning before that. And just, you know, notice how our culture is being manipulated along with our fears and everything else. Thanks for being with us today, my friends. We'll see you again tomorrow, same time, same place. I'm Tom Hartman. And don't forget, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.